Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, continues to receive international headlines. Today's guest, Jonathan Landay, reports that, like the rest of the world, the U.S. government appeared to have been taken aback last month when Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, fell to an offensive by jihadis of the Islamic State that triggered the collapse of five Iraqi army divisions and carried the extremists to the threshold of Baghdad. He reports that a review of the record shows that the Obama administration was not surprised at all. In congressional testimony as far back as November, U.S. diplomats and intelligence officials made clear that the U.S. had been closely tracking the al-Qaeda spinoff since 2012. And the testimony, which received very little media attention at the time, also showed that Obama administration officials were well aware of the group's declared intention to turn its Syrian sanctuary into a springboard from which it would send men and material back into Iraq and unleash waves of suicidal bombings there. They also knew that the Iraqi security forces could not handle it. So joining us to talk about this and coverage of ISIS is Jonathan Landay, national security and intelligence reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. And Jonathan joins us from Washington. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So this is a pretty damning report. And like you said, this testimony did not receive much media attention at the time. First off, talk a little bit about this testimony. Who testified and who heard the testimony?
Well, for the most part, for the most part, the testimony came from the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, Brett McGurk. He worked both for the Bush administration on Iraq and was brought back by the Obama administration to kind of be their diplomatic point man on Iraq. He testified first before a subcommittee in November, last November, of the House International Relations Committee, Foreign Relations Committee, and then to the full committee again in February, I believe it was. And also, in the intervening time, there was also what they have every year from, which is a hearing or a set of hearings in which the heads of the U.S. intelligence community, beginning with the deputy director of National Intelligence, former General James Clapper, as well as the head of the CIA and the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. They present kind of what they call their annual threat assessment, and it's an examination of what the U.S. intelligence community believes are the major national security issues that will face the United States in the coming year. And there was some pretty revealing testimony from several of those gentlemen as well. And so I went back and I combed through all of this testimony and talked to other people, including some senior intelligence officials, and came to understand the following, that the United States had been closely tracking the growth of what we now know to be the Islamic State. Prior to that, it was known as the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Shams, or Iraq and Syria. The United States government calls it the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. And prior to that, its prior manifestation was as al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they've been keeping a pretty close watch in this on the development of this group. Let's not forget that when the United States, at the time the United States left Iraq, al-Qaeda in Iraq was a shadow of its former self. It had been pretty badly beaten, although not eliminated, and its leadership decided to make a strategic move across the border into civil war-racked Syria, take over a part of a very small chunk northeastern Syria, around in the province of Raqqa, and make that their headquarters. And from there, they were able to rebuild, recruit a lot of foreign fighters. A lot of Iraqis came over there, and from there they began re-infiltrating back into or sending fighters back into Iraq and staging this series of increasing series of very destructive car bombs and suicide bombings in Baghdad and other places, but concentrating on Baghdad, concentrating on Shiite areas of Baghdad, then breaking into prisons, breaking a lot of their own people out of prisons. Abu Ghraib was one of these places, and from there expanding and joining and taking advantage of the fact that there was this Sunni uprising that was going on as a result of the very sectarian policies of a soon-to-be former Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. They were able to infiltrate and join that uprising, and earlier this year saw them take over the Anbar town of Fallujah, city of Fallujah, with which Americans, I think, are very familiar now, given the battles that the United States fought there during its occupation, and almost took over the city of Ramadi. And then we saw them launch the offensive at Mosul. And we come to understand from the most recent testimony of Mr. McGurk, which was last month, that the United States knew 3 days before the assault on Mosul that it was going to take place, and that it, in fact, had contacted the Maliki government, asked them to please send reinforcements. It did not do that. And we saw the collapse as a result, we saw the assault on Mosul and the takeover of the city by ISIS, now the Islamic State. It declared itself, it declared this caliphate, calls itself the Islamic State now, and the collapse, the implosion of five Iraqi army divisions who basically, abandoned their weapons. Some of them took off their uniforms, put on civilian clothes, and flee. A lot of them were caught, hundreds of them were caught. And we know that a lot were executed by ISIS when they were caught. And all this time, the United States was watching what was going on, was watching the development of ISIS, and trying to use this as a means of pressuring the Maliki government into instituting the kind of reforms that the United States believes will result in kind of bringing back aggrieved Sunnis back to the fold, back into the support of the government, and allowing a reproduction of what was very successful for the United States in Iraq, and that was the so-called Iraq Awakening, where the United States was able to recruit Sunnis to turn on, back then, al-Qaeda in Iraq, the same actors that we see now return to Iraq.
Jonathan, is it safe to assume that the administration knew it would unfold like it is? I mean, it's so bad. We're hoping to connect with Martin Chulov of The Guardian. He's got this horrific piece about how Yazidi girls are being kidnapped by ISIS. One father received a phone call saying his daughter would be sold as a slave for $10. I mean, that's just one of so many horrific stories that we're reading.
Put it this way, the United States knew what the goals of this group was because their leader, their emir, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, had made it clear publicly what it was. He put out statements online about what they intended to do, the formation of the caliphate. He announced these various phases of their campaign, their offensive in Iraq, the Breaking the Walls campaign, which he spelled out, we're going to go break into prisons and get our guys out. And I'm sure there were other means by which the United States was able to track what was going on, or was tracking what was going on. To the extent that they are as horrific and savage a group as they are, I'm not sure how much that the United States intelligence community was able to predict that or was able to assess that, but there's no doubt that they've been pretty savage. They were pretty savage when they were fighting the Assad regime and still are fighting the Assad regime in Syria, resorting to decapitations and and this kind of savagery. So that they would be making slaves of young women, forcing them into marriages. I don't know how much was predictable.
And let me ask you this, but I also want to give out the phone number, because now the word ISIS is just thrown out on a regular basis, and I do wonder if people know. In fact, I'd love to get your take on this. What is ISIS? Who are these people? How are you able to report on this and get this information? But I would also like to give out the phone number if any of you have questions about ISIS and you have any comments based on what you've been reading. What are your thoughts about the media coverage, because this is getting so much attention? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Jonathan Lande is national security and intelligence reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. He's reporting that the Obama administration knew that ISIS was growing but did little to counter it. So based on that, Jonathan, what would you say to those people who say, okay, 40,000 Iraqis are stranded? We've heard and seen stories about dehydration. I mean, there have been horrific stories about parents cutting their arms to actually give their children their blood so they're not dying from dehydration. And people are saying something needs to be done about this. So what would you say to those people based on the information that you're reporting about the administration knowing about this group before it did anything?
Well, as I said, we have to be very careful about what we believe and what we don't believe in this entire situation, because we as reporters are not able to get to a lot of places.
Right.
And it turns out, in fact, that the Pentagon yesterday said that its initial assessment of the situation involving these tens of thousands of Yazidis who were up on, who fled into the Sinjar Mountains from ISIS, that their situation was not as bad as was initially assessed, and that initial assessment was what had the administration and the British contemplating a major military rescue operation. And so a lot of you've got to be very careful in reporting anything that you don't see with your own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
From this particular region. Now, a lot of what we know about the Islamic State of the Islamic State, as it now calls itself, we get not just from Syrian activists who have been tracking this group when it was fighting in Syria, but their own. They've got an incredibly sophisticated propaganda operation that utilizes YouTube. There's a lot on Twitter. They send out a lot of tweets. They have supporters and allies that we refer to them as fanboys, who will retweet things or news concerning ISIS. In fact, I'm looking at one of their latest tweets just now, is that they're claiming that ISIS just captured a town called Dabiq, which is in the north of Aleppo, near the Syrian Iraqi border. This is an extremely strategic location because it kind of provides a doorway into the second largest city in Syria, what was the commercial capital of Syria, where you have what's left of sort of the quote-unquote moderate U.S.-backed opposition that has not only been fighting against ISIS, but is it fighting to stave off an offensive by the Assad regime. And so, what this tells you is that this group is continuing to expand. It's been on a tear, not just in Iraq, but also in Syria, in a number of provinces of Syria. And what they look to be doing now is not only going for Aleppo, but going for control of territory between Aleppo and the Turkish border, which will give them access to more access to the Turkish border, and allow them to cut off the remaining supply corridor to what's left of the so-called moderate Syrian opposition that, in theory, the United States was talking about backing.
Well, we have a few calls on this, so let's hear from Ida in Belmont. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for addressing our problems. So I'm Syrian, I'm from Damascus,
mm-hmm.
and I just want to go, and for us, we know that Daesh, which you call the Islamic, mm-hmm. Whatever you call
State.
It, Islamiyah, we know that they are in Assad's pocket. We actually, all the Arab media is covering this. Raghida Dilman, who writes even for the Huffington Post and for sometimes for the New York Times, she has, I mean, completely linked them together. Yet the Obama administration refuses to acknowledge that they are hand-in-hand with Assad, because every time they raid in northern Aleppo and in Idlib and all the Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor, they receive aerial coverage. They don't get bombed. But the Free Syrian Army always gets bombed. So why no one ever addresses that? And whatever happened to our 750,000 raped women in Syria and our 2 million children homeless and our lost generation? I mean, suddenly it's the Yazidis, which I am 100% worried about. But, I mean, we need to, we can think on several fronts. It's not just the Yazidis, it's the Syrians, it's the Iraqis, it's the Yazidis.
Those are all really good questions. In fact, you know, we did spent a lot of time investigating the allegations, mostly coming from the Syrian opposition, the moderates who are based outside of the moderate political leadership based outside of Syria, mostly in Turkey, that in fact, as you call them, Daesh, or the Islamic State and the Assad regime were working hand in hand, and we were unable to come up, and we spent a lot of time. We have a Syrian reporter who works for us. We've spent a lot of time trying to delve into that, and we've not been able to come up with concrete evidence. In fact, a lot of this seems to be based on the fact that early on in the civil war in Syria, Assad released thousands of prisoners from his jails, who included guys who went on to become members of Daesh. But beyond that, yes,
which were swept up during the Iraqi.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. But here's the thing: what seems to be the case, and I don't think anybody has really come up with hard evidence, concrete evidence of what you're talking about. But you're right. What we saw going on for quite a long time was that Assad would leave ISIS alone. ISIS wouldn't attack Assad's groups, and both of them would be attacking the rest of the opposition. But let me stop.
The doctors and the school teachers.
Yes.
The Syrian revolution that President Obama felt
I'm not worthy of saving. Right. I'm not disagreeing with you. But here's the thing: what this actually appeared to be was an accommodation, or at least I should say a tactic by both sides, because what both sides were looking at was the fact that it's easier for them to attack the weaker parties, right, then attack each other and lose more men. But that changed. That has changed within the last month, where you have seen ISIS on a major offensive, not just in Raqqa, where it has overrun numerous Syrian military bases, attacking the Syrian army, and they're on the verge of taking out the final last major Syrian military airport in Raqqa. But they've also done the same thing in Hasaka, where they've overrun several major military bases, Deir ez-Zor as well, and I think you're going to see them going at the Syrian military in Aleppo. They have also been fighting the Syrian military outside of Homs, and they've been moving against the Syrian military in Hama, believe it or not, as well. So I don't think that it's the case that that Assad created ISIS, it was working with ISIS, but that for a long time they were willing to kind of accommodate each other because both of them had easier enemies to attack. But I don't think that's the case anymore, and I think you're going to see increasing circumstances in which the Syrian military and ISIS are in direct conflict, and I think that this is going to be a big problem for President Assad.
Hmm. Well, thank you for calling, Ida. Jonathan, how big is ISIS? A number of reports say that they are on a recruiting spree. How are they able to recruit so many people? What is their main message?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we had a briefing from U.S. intelligence officials yesterday, kind of just going over how they see this group, and frankly, they're not even sure how big they are, because, you know, there's a lot of, for instance, you have alliances, perhaps of accommodation, of convenience, going on between ISIS and some of the Sunni tribes in Iraq that are on again, off again. So at one point you might have a lot of these tribal fighters fighting for ISIS, and at another time they're not fighting for ISIS. And you have the same thing going on with regard to foreign fighters. You have thousands of foreign fighters who've come in, fought for ISIS, but then a lot of them will leave. And we've seen instances where, for instance, there was an attack on a Jewish synagogue by a French citizen of Arab ethnicity, I believe, who had fought in Syria with ISIS and gone back. And I think last week, the police in Kosovo staged a series of raids where they picked up more than 20 people who had fought with ISIS in Syria. And so it's a shifting number. I don't think anybody, certainly the U.S. intelligence community admits it doesn't have a hard number. It isn't going back, in fact, and reassessing that very question. And so nobody really knows, quite frankly. But one thing is for certain, that there was a relatively small number of them when they went and attacked Mosul and took it over, and that the group has hugely expanded since then, because you know nothing is a greater recruiting tool than success when you're on a roll the way they have been, where they have not only taken as war booty U.S.-made weapon systems abandoned by the Iraqi army, but they have oil wells, they have gas wells, they have control of banks. I mean, they are a well-resourced and I don't even want to call them a guerrilla group, because they're more like a regular army now, in that they move in very large formations with armor and pickup trucks and heavy weaponry. And so, as I said, nothing is a better recruiting tool than success.
Well, let's take one more call before break. Let's hear from Gren in Alameda. Hi, Gren. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me. Enjoying the show. My question has to do with Saudi Arabia. It seems to me that they've been the ideological and monetary backing behind most Sunni extremism for the last couple of decades now, and certainly 9/11, there were Saudi people figuring very heavily in that. And I wondered what, if any, role they might be playing in this, because they just seem to be funding all these people.
It's actually a great question, too. I don't think there's any doubt that the Saudis were bankrolling and arming some of the Sunni insurgent groups in Syria. I have grave doubts that the Saudi government itself was funding or supporting ISIS in any way, simply because it is aligned. It's a breakaway of al-Qaeda, and the Saudi government has had some pretty serious problems with al-Qaeda. It's the affiliate on the Arabian Peninsula, and I don't think that they would go so far as to be arming and supporting a group that they themselves are fighting. But the Saudis were very open when shortly after the Syrian civil war began, where you had Saudi leaders saying, you know, if we can't stand by and allow these people to be slaughtered, as did the Qataris as well. And there's no doubt that both have provided support for some of the Sunni insurgent groups in Syria, although whether or not they're giving to ISIS is doubtful. But there's no doubt, however, that there are private donations. There have been private donations coming in to ISIS from the Gulf. But it's at least as far as the U.S. intelligence community is concerned, they see ISIS more overwhelmingly as a self-sustaining, self-funding organization
Jonathan, hold that thought. That's Jonathan Landay with McClatchy, and we'll be back right after this short break.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective that's not been heard yet, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC, and the week's news wrap-up continues tonight at 6 with Day 6 from the CBC in Toronto with guest host Peter Armstrong, Left, Right, and Center at 7 and Counterspin at 7:30.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about the process involved in determining what drugs get made and how much they'll cost. We're going to talk about efforts to use experimental drugs to combat the Ebola virus in West Africa. How do drugs move from the experimental stage to full approval? And how can we support research for new drugs, especially when they're not profitable? That's on Monday. Tuesday, we will talk about what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri, by focusing on the militarization of police forces across the country. We're also putting shows about how young people from low-income communities are beating the odds and graduating from high school and college. And we'll talk about a new book, War of the Whales, by Joshua Horowitz, taking a look at how two men faced off against the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Navy's best-kept secret, a submarine surveillance system that floods entire ocean basins with high-intensity sounds. That's coming up next week. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're joined by Jonathan Landay, national security and intelligence reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. He and his colleagues won a number of awards for asking hard-hitting questions in the lead-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And Jonathan has been covering the Middle East for some time. We're talking with him specifically today about ISIS. And if you have any questions about media coverage, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And because Gren talked about Saudi Arabia, what are your thoughts on the media questioning Saudi Arabia's role in other countries? I mean, Iraq, Afghanistan, you name it. And then also there's news this week that Saudi Arabia gave the United Nations $100 million to fight terrorism.
Well, I mean, nations have interests, and the Saudis are no different from any other nation. They see different places around the world as being places where they wish to exert their influence. They have been heavily influencing the situation in Afghanistan, as we know, in Pakistan even now, because you know, they see this kind of as a place where they can where they are able to influence the political situation, including through their support of Salafi type, you know, hardline Muslim organizations. Certainly, they have been very influential within the Sunni opposition to the Assad regime. They've been extremely influential in Lebanon, and I think in a positive way. You know, I was just there, and it's amazing that there's, you know, there's been this enormous amount of outside investment, including a lot of Saudi money, into the rebuilding of Beirut. And when the Syrian civil war first began, you know, there was a lot of dire predictions of how it was going to, you know, it was going to infect Lebanon, and Lebanon was stood on the verge of a precipice. And certainly there has been serious repercussions in Lebanon itself from the Syrian civil war. We just saw a big fight up on the border with Syria in a place called Arsal, where Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the official al-Qaeda syndicate in fighting in Syria, which had once time been part of ISIS, where they were involved in fighting the Lebanese army, and you've had problems up in the northern city of Tripoli between Alawites, who are loyal, who are supporters of Assad, and Sunnis, who obviously support the Syrian opposition. But that the dire predictions of massive war returning to Lebanon have not proven so, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the Saudis, the Iranians, anyone else who's got major influence there, plus, of course, the Lebanese elite itself, don't want to see all of that investment jeopardized and gone down the drain again, and yet a new round of destruction. And so, you know, I think that they've probably played a very positive role there.
A quick question from a listener. Please address the difference between ISIS and ISIL, ISIL, as called by the president's press representative.
Right. There's no difference. It's the same group. So it depends how you... It's a group that calls itself the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham. Now, Sham is the region of Syria, Lebanon, part of Turkey, Iraq, that ISIS wants to, where they've wants to overrun, basically, and turn into this caliphate of theirs. ISIL is the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, is the same region, and so we, the press, and a lot of other experts refer to the group as ISIS, whereas the American government refers to it as ISIL, but they're the same group.
Okay.
It's confusing, I know.
Okay. Well, thank you for the email. Let's go back to callers. Let's hear from Sarah and Carmel. Hi, Sarah. Hi, do we have Sarah? Sarah, sorry about that. You can give us a call back if you're still listening. Jonathan, where do you see this going? And why do you think that what we're seeing is so violent? I mean, I brought up Martin Chulov's reporting. He's on the ground there, again, talking to families whose daughters are being sold as slaves for $10. And again, there were horrible reports about parents cutting their arms to give their children their blood to drink because there's no water to drink.
Right. If I knew the answer to that, I'd be putting money in various places and getting rich. I wish I could tell you. And I don't have any doubt that this is going to get worse before it gets better. And the reason I say that is because you have this immediate situation that's going on right now, this terrible tragedy that's going on in Iraq. You have this 3-year civil war that's been going on in Syria. And yet there are underlying issues that afflict a larger part of that region that are contributing to the fact that you have these young men, legions of young men who feel extremely disenfranchised, who are willing to go and join this group or groups like it and fight. And those reasons, those underlying reasons are things like the lack of good governance, corruption among the elites that run that part of the world, unemployment, unemployment, poverty, growing environmental degradation, et cetera, and all of this is leaving members of what's known as the youth bulge, and 60%, I believe, is the figure I've seen, of that part of the world are below the age of 20 or 25. And so when you don't feel like you have a future, and when you see your aspirations, your political aspirations, perhaps being represented more concretely by a group like the Islamic State, you will gravitate that way. I mean, I saw that happen in Bosnia, where I spent most of the war. I covered the Bosnian Civil War, which began as I shouldn't say Civil War, the Bosnian War, where the longer there was no Western assistance to the Bosnians, the more some of those Bosnians who were labeled Muslims for an ethnic reason, because even though they're ethnically not the same, they're the same as the Serbs and the Croats, where some of them began saying, you know what, the only people who are willing to help us are Islamic extremists. And so you saw them beginning to come in and fight on behalf in some parts of Bosnia for the Bosnian army. And I think that's what you see going on to a great extent in that region, in the Middle East, this growing lack of prospects for young people. And beyond that, I think another serious reason, major reason for the viciousness is that when the United States invaded, when the Bush administration invaded Iraq, it took the top off the pressure cooker of this centuries-old rivalry feud, blood feud between the two branch, main branches of Islam, the Sunnis and the Shia. And so there's a great deal of sectarian hatred that you have to throw into this cauldron, into the fuel of what's going on. And I don't think that there's anyone, whether it's the United States, the European, or the Arab leaders themselves, who have got a long-term strategy to address these really serious underlying problems that are helping to fuel what we see going on. In fact, those problems are going to get worse, not better. And that's why I say, to a great extent, I think that the situation that we see the tragedy we see unfolding in both Syria and Iraq are going to get worse before they get better.
Well, let's take one more call on this. Let's hear from Dory in San Francisco. Hi, Dory.
Hey, Rose. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi.
I want to get back to the point. Actually, I have 2 points. One is about Assad's strategy with IS. And from what I understand, it's at least, you know, for even a couple of months now, the so-called moderate rebels are not even in the equation anymore. They're not a factor on the ground. They've been essentially wiped out by Assad and IS. And I think it's a strategy not just of kind of getting the easier target out of the way, but now Assad can really change the narrative so that he's the better option than the spread of IS in Syria. And, I mean, that would have been inconceivable a year ago, but now the West might have to say, you know, better the devil we know than ISIS, than IS. So that's that point of view.
I think that's a really, really good point. I think you're right. I think that he allowed ISIS to kind of expand because it helped his narrative. Not that at this point the United States or the Europeans have grasped it, although there was a point very briefly where there are some European intelligence agencies did go send people to Damascus to kind of explore the possibility of maybe Assad could help them with identifying some of the foreign jihadis who had gone to Syria to fight. But yes, it's an excellent point.
And also, Assad has said from the beginning that he's fighting terrorism, which from the beginning was bogus, but now it's not. So there's really no civil war in Syria anymore. It's not, you know, a genuine uprising that, you know, he is indeed fighting terrorism, if you want to call. And I think if IS is not terrorism, I don't know what is. So that also strengthens his hand. And one point about Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, as you probably know, he spent 4 years in Camp Buka, is that the
Buka.
Way you say it? In southern
Buka.
Iraq.
Yes.
There are different theories as to whether the imprisonment radicalized him or whether he already was. But of course, we do know that many people do get radicalized in prison. But the question is, why was he released in 2009?
They're all good questions. And in fact, we do know from U.S. intelligence officials that, in fact, most, if not all, of the leadership of ISIS spent time in American custody during the American occupation of Iraq. And there's very little doubt among American intelligence analysts that, in fact, a lot of these guys met in custody. Whether he was radicalized to the extent he is now in prison, I can't answer that question. I do know that at the time that he was in American custody, he was not in a leadership position. He was a kind of a small time Islamic scholar, but that obviously he and the cohorts that he met went on after they're released to learn, to adapt, to understand, and to build. And we see what we have today is the world's most savage, although efficient, savagely efficient terrorist organization it's ever known.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Dori. We're speaking today with Jonathan Landay, national security and intelligence reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, and you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And Jonathan, I wanted to just ask you quickly, we're going to talk about James Risen in a minute. Let's talk about that now because we have our next guest on the line. I'd like to welcome David Barstow to the show. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter with the New York Times. You might remember that, gosh, I can't believe it's been so long, but back in 2008, he wrote a really great piece about pundits on TV working for the Pentagon and working for weapons companies. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Nice to have you. So I wanted to talk a bit about James Risen because a number of Pulitzer Prize winning reporters, 14, released statements on Monday in support of New York Times reporter James Risen. He's refusing to testify in the prosecution of a CIA officer accused of leaking classified information about Iran's nuclear program. He basically either has to testify or potentially face jail time. Can you talk about the significance of these Pulitzer Prize winners coming to James Risen's defense, David? Did we lose David? Okay, we're having some phone lines. Jonathan, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that this is an extremely serious case. I've appeared I was on a program with Mr. Risen a couple of months ago, where that dealt with the question of the Obama administration's crackdown on the media in the name of national security versus the public's right to know and the duty of journalists like myself and like Jim Risen to burrow in and get the truth of what their government is doing in the name of the American people. And we have, you know, a lot of people argue, well, this was all classified and you're not allowed to know this stuff and it's against the law, to which I would respond, Pentagon Papers and my own work on what was top secret intelligence that the Bush administration used to justify the invasion of Iraq, virtually all of which turned out to be exaggerated or bogus. And so, you know, I will offer that to those who try to defend what the government does vis-a-vis the press. It is admittedly a difficult balancing act, but what's most significant about Mr. Risen's case is that I believe it went to the Supreme Court. They refused to hear the case, and now, you know, we're waiting to hear what the final judicial disposition in this case is going to be and whether or not Mr. Risen is going to go to jail for refusing to confirm what I believe is already known about the information that he put in his book. I think it's extremely significant, and it's already had a major impact, not just this case, but a whole bunch of cases involving, in fact, the most cases that any administration in American history has brought against reporters in an effort to learn who their sources are in order to suppress the information that they obtain. And this will only make things worse. I mean, and we're not talking about just what they call this chilling effect on leaks of classified information. The Obama administration has set out a program as a result of both WikiLeaks and then the Snowden leaks. They call the Insider Threat Program. And basically, it's a program that requires that's intended to shut down all unauthorized releases of information, not just classified, but unclassified as well. Mm-hmm. And it's spread across all of the departments of government. And basically what it says is we want to try and it set up these insider leak units within every department, and their job is to detect people who have, are, or may in the future sometime down the road leak information without permission, not just to the press, but whether to basically anyone. This has a really chilling effect on my ability to go to people in the government, particularly on the national security side, to say, look, I'm not asking you about a secret. The administration announced this decision today. Please put this in the context of what American policy has been, what and the situation that it applies to. And we even can't get that anymore. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking, or it's much harder to get that now, with that, you know, unless of course the person has been authorized by the administration to talk to you. And what that does, at least in the way I see things, is that it has a chilling, it has a deleterious effect on the quality of our democracy. Because it's my job as a reporter to try and educate to the best of my ability my readers about what the government is doing in their name. And if I can't get someone who's involved in policy to try and put a decision in context, I'm not asking, not talking about classified information, I'm just talking about putting foreign policy decisions in context, then that has then that denies critical information to the people that this government, in theory, is representing.
That's Jonathan Lande, national security and intelligence reporter for McClatchy, and I'm hoping we have David Barstow back with us. David, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Sorry about that. So, David, your colleague James Risen said that the Obama administration is the greatest enemy of press freedom in a generation. He did not mince words when he said that. How do you think this potential jail time and the fact that the Obama administration is cracking down so hard, how is that affecting the work that reporters are doing right now?
I think I can second what Jonathan just said based on my own firsthand reporting. I think the thing that's so stunning to me is how effective this crackdown has been in scaring the bejesus out of even longtime trusted sources, people I've been dealing with for many, many years who work in government, and including those who actually have nothing to do at all with national security, but work in other areas of the federal government. I think everyone in Washington is, because of this kind of relentless pursuit of Jim and other reporters and whistleblowers by the Obama administration, it's just... had, you know, it's done incredible damage already in the ability of reporters to ferret out the kinds of information that the government wants to cloak behind secrecy. And sometimes anyone who does this kind of work for any amount of time comes to quickly learn that the cloak of classification is used to do a lot more than just guard genuine secrets. It's often used to guard and to protect things that are huge embarrassments to the government, malfeasance, misspending of resources, huge intelligence blunders. And so to me, the reason why I think listeners should be concerned about what's going on right now in the federal government is because this trend, if it continues, will simply invest more and more and more power in the hands of a select few in Washington to determine basically the boundaries of public debate. Mm. They will get to decide kind of what facts do we get to know. And that power, that power over the information, is an enormous power. And if you really want to understand that, you need to look no further than Edward Snowden. Until Edward Snowden came along, we had no ability to truly have a debate about the extent of a kind of dragnet surveillance society, because we just didn't know the details, or we didn't know them in a kind of concrete and specific way that we now do because of the Snowden revelations. And so I think the subtext of this is really about who, you know, the effort on the part of political leaders to control the framework within which we debate really important policy issues. So that's why I'm really concerned.
James Risen was awarded the Newspaper Guild's Press Freedom Prize on Wednesday. This is now starting to get a lot more media attention. David, just quickly, because we're almost out of time, why do you think the Obama administration is cracking down so hard? What is its motivation behind this?
I think it's one of the really great mysteries of the Obama administration. This is a man who used to speak highly before he was president of the United States about the importance of whistleblowers and transparency, and who came into office pledging to be the most transparent president in the history. And I have to agree with Risen. I didn't think it could get much worse than the Bush years, and it's gotten way worse than the Obama years. And I'm kind of stunned by that, just because it seems to fly in the face of the kinds of pledges and promises that he made when he came into office. It's really hard to understand what the thinking is, because this assault on basic press freedom is so corrosive to a healthy democracy. This is what we see happening in places like Russia and China, in the kinds of countries that we don't want to be. And here it is playing out right here in the United States of America.
Jonathan, 30 seconds. What are your thoughts on that, the motivations behind this?
I think there's a genuine motivation to try and crack down on leaks of classified information, because the guy who is running, kind of overseeing this whole business, is the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, who's never been known as being very press-friendly. And I agree that what this does is, not only does it restrict access to different points of view, but it increases the ability of the government to get its point of view through without the filters of journalists who know subjects and are able to sort of analyze them, because now you can go to the government can go directly to the web, put its version of events directly on the web, bypass any kind of analytical filters, and go straight to the public with its version of things.
Well, we're definitely going to have to cover this again. We might have a roundtable of national security reporters on, so we'd love to have both of you back. Jonathan Lande is a national security and intelligence reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, and David Barstow is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter with the New York Times. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What's the process involved in determining what drugs get made and how much they'll cost? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about efforts to use experimental drugs to combat the Ebola virus in West Africa. What are the implications of using experimental drugs, and how do drugs move from the experimental stage to full approval? What are other ways we can regulate and support research for new drugs? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulip is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.